It's the Root Cellar, where regional history and family folklore come together, with your hosts Jim and Jan Strandley.
A place like no other is the quote taken from the book Minnesota 150, written by Kate Roberts, describing the confluence of the Mississippi River and Minnesota rivers, which is our topic for the Root Cellar this time. The book describes the people, places, and things that shape our state. One can actually witness these items in the sesquicentennial exhibit at the Minnesota History Center building in St. Paul. The confluence of the Mississippi River and the Minnesota River is where present-day Mendota is located. It has been a hub of historical activity since man first located there 9,000 to 10,000 years ago. The ancient Paleo-Indians used this area to hunt the mighty giant bison. A spear point made from limestone and quarried nearby was found by archaeologists and dated back to that period of time. The Paleo-Indians were the forerunners of the early Native Americans who used the area for their residence and homes. The early Sioux and Dakota natives farmed, hunted, and prepared to fight their enemy, the Ojibwa, for hundreds of years. In 1805, a lieutenant in the Army of the United States came to the area. His purpose was to bargain with the natives and acquire land to build a military outpost to protect this new area of the country from the British and to try and keep peace between the traditional warring Indian nations, the Dakota and the Ojibwa. How did the United States acquire the land in the first place? President Thomas Jefferson purchased the land from Napoleon Bonaparte, the leader of France, in 1803. This was called the Louisiana Purchase. It amounted to just a few cents an acre for the entire central portion of the country from the Canadian border to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, anyway, Jefferson sent Zebulon Pike to find a place for a fort, and after his exploration of the area, determined that the bluffs overlooking the rivers and the island between the two rivers would be an excellent location. That island eventually was named Pike Island. The bluffs area, owned by the Dakota, was worth plenty, according to Lieutenant Pike, but Washington allowed him to pay the natives only $2,000 for thousands of acres, and the payment arrived many years later. It wasn't until 14 years after the deal was made that the first soldiers arrived to begin construction of the fort. They endured many hardships and progress was slow. In 1820, Colonel Josiah Snelling took over and he got the job done in the next 4 years. The military generals were so impressed with the colonel's work that they recommended the fort be called Fort Snelling, and it remains the same name to this day. The fort became the meeting place for diverse cultures. The Dakota and Ojibwa held peace talks there and did some trading. Traders, trappers, and explorers used the fort as a haven for rest and relaxation and a stepping stone to the frontier. Even tourists later on traversed the Mississippi in steamboats from the south and visited the area, including the frontier outpost. When the Dakota War broke out in 1862, the fort was used as a training area. The soldiers left from the fort to put down the uprising. After the war was over, the native prisoners were kept at the fort, and many died of disease and poor treatment. They finally were transferred to steamboats and brought to South Dakota to live on reservations, never to set foot in their native land again. How many of you have visited Fort Snelling? It has been restored to resemble the original military complex. If you are interested in Minnesota history, a visit to the fort is a must. It is open in the summer months and is certainly worth the trip. Jan and I have taken the grandchildren there, and they have had lots of fun and learned about our Minnesota heritage. Visiting there, one gets the impression that it holds many stories. It is a place in history that is important to many and held sacred by many more. For example, it was here where the famous rugged frontiersman settled nearby and sold his brewed liquor to the people living at the fort. Yes, it was Pierre Pigseye Parent, who was one of the first inhabitants of the region, who lived in a cave and got his name from his battered face and bulging eye caused by too many barroom brawls. St. Paul could have been called Pig's Eye today, but because a priest built a chapel close by and called it St. Paul's Church, the area became known as St. Paul's Landing. The people living there liked this name better. St. Paul's Landing became the center of activity over the next few years. Henry Sibley ran his American Fur Trade Company from this area. Lawrence Tolliver, the Indian agent for the area, was based here. Steamboats began to arrive at St. Paul's Landing on a regular basis, bringing more people to settle the lush wilderness and clear the land and farm the area nearby. Civilization was clearly changing the purpose and shape of the territory. Fort Snelling was never attacked, but remained as a solid protection for new settlers. It was used during the Civil War as a training area, and also during World War I as an officer training ground. Today, it is barely noticed by the travelers driving by in cars along Interstate 494 or Highway No. 5. Air travelers can see the area and take it for granted as they land and take off from the two airports nearby. But one can almost feel the spirits of those individuals who existed there thousands of years ago until the present time when you get near the place. Nowadays, traveling by fast rail from the Mall of America to downtown Minneapolis, one goes right by the fort and also the impressive National Cemetery with literally acres of little white crosses designating all the military personnel buried there. Has the confluence of the mighty Mississippi River and the Minnesota River made an impact on the history of our state? You bet it did. Culturally, the confluence has been the backdrop for major change throughout time. It is a place to be cherished and held sacred. Now here is Jan, whom I cherish and hold sacred. We just celebrated our 17th wedding anniversary together.
Goodness, you never know what he's going to say. But we did just celebrate our 17th wedding anniversary. And also on the day of the 31st, when Kathy and Virgil celebrated their anniversary, I was honored to be a bridesmaid at another special wedding. But that's another story. So today, in talking about the rivers of Minnesota and the Native Americans, I have chosen to talk about wild rice. And if you want to grab a pencil and a piece of paper, I've got a really good recipe at the end of the program. Okay? Here we go. To say that wild rice only comes from Minnesota is a false statement. Wild rice is native to the United States and grows in fresh water and in brackish swamps from New England to Texas to North Dakota. Did you know that? But its greatest abundance has always been in the state of Minnesota. It grows in nearly every state east of the Rocky Mountains and has some 60 local names, many of them associated with Indian names of the area it grows. Although wild rice is one of America's native foods, along with cranberries, pumpkins, etc., it isn't just grown in the United States either. Wild rice is native across the North American continent from Canada all the way down to Mexico. And today it's now planted and grown worldwide, especially in China and Japan, where it also bears 11 different Chinese and Japanese names. And I'm sure that part of the reason is because of its wonderful nutritional value. Wild rice reaches its greatest size, however, in the southern United States, where it may grow as high as 12 feet, with a stalk over 2 inches in diameter. In the northern region, it grows no higher than 3 or 4 feet, and it does love deep, rich soil. Wild rice is cooked and used just like brown or white rice, and is often combined with them. The Ojibwe and Sioux Indians of Minnesota call wild rice manomen. The early French explorers in Minnesota and Canada called it Folies Avoine, and that's French for wild oats. Ironically, wild rice isn't really a rice at all. It's an aquatic cereal grain with a biological technical name of Zizania aquatica, and I'm sure I have not pronounced that correctly. How is wild rice harvested? Well, it's one process that modern technology still has not touched. The rice is still harvested the same way today as it was years and years ago. It's usually done in a canoe or a low-sided wooden boat. One person poles the boat through the rice bed while another person in the boat knocks the rice kernels off the stalks and into the boat. It's done with two long sticks, and with one hand you bend the plants over into the boat, and while holding the plants down, you beat the kernels off into the boat. Needless to say, this person has to be coordinated and also skilled as to not tip the boat over, or the entire process is lost. The rice is then taken to the location where it is processed. The hulls are removed, cleaned of debris, dried, and ready for bagging and selling. The basic cooking method of wild rice is to wash the rice thoroughly by running it under cold water in a strainer. Add 1 cup of raw wild rice to 3 cups of boiling water in a heavy saucepan or pot. Reduce the heat and simmer covered for 35 to 50 minutes, or just until those kernels puff open. Then uncover the kettle, fluff it with a fork, and simmer 5 more minutes. Drain off any of the excess fluid, and if you like chewier rice, cook it less time, and this will make approximately 3 to 4 cups of cooked rice. The lumberjacks in the olden days used to make wild rice for breakfast. They cooked the wild rice, tossed in brown sugar and milk or cream, and it made for a real stick-to-your-ribs breakfast. They ate this so that they could skip lunch and work all day without losing their energy until supper time. Thus, it's very high in calories and carbohydrates, but good. Except I found another source about wild rice that says it's a very nutritional product for those who are watching their weight, because a generous serving of wild rice contains less than 50 calories. Here are some more interesting facts about wild rice. It's known to be harvested by the Native Americans hundreds of years ago in Minnesota. The plants grew wild in swamps, and the seeds were found to attract fish and waterfowl, so they were planted in ponds, marshes, and bays by sportsmen, and that's how the species spread. And today, most rice is planted. This rice is naturally grown rice. It generates year after year. Northern wild rice is an annual, which means each plant only lives 1 year. The plant drops seeds from its head to ensure next year's crop. So you can't take all of it or there won't be any left for next year. Wild rice is considered a delicacy besides being a healthy, natural, and delicious food. It is high in protein and low in fat. It converts easily to energy in the body and contains proteins essential to growth. It's easily digested, rich in thiamine, riboflavin, and vitamin B. Besides all that, it tastes just wonderful. And here is my recipe for wild rice with pork chops or chicken breasts. Very simple. You need 1 cup uncooked wild rice, rinsed under cold water and drained, 6 pork chops or equivalent amounts of chicken breasts, 1 3/4 cup chicken broth, and 1 can of cream of mushroom soup, or cream of celery, or cream of chicken. You brown the meat, stir together the broth, the soup, and the wild rice, and place in a 9x13 baking dish. Add the meat, stir a little bit to incorporate the meat into the mixture, cover tightly with tin foil, and bake at 350 degrees for 1.5 to 2 hours. The rice should then be slightly curled and tender and delicious. And there's our program for today. Have a happy new year. Bye.